Support for Valley Edition comes from the James Irvine Foundation.
This is Valley Edition, FM 89's weekly look at the issues that matter to the residents of the San Joaquin Valley.
Hello, I'm Juanita Stevenson, and welcome to Valley Edition. On our program today, the Valley's air, water, and land use. A study says we need to do better. And fallout from the state park surplus scandal. Plus, Fresno Chaffee Zoo prepares to open the first of many new exhibits funded by Measure Z money, your tax dollars. But first, the state of the Great Central Valley, a report focusing on the Valley's air quality, water, land use, energy development, waste. How are we managing it all? The report says we can and should do better. Joining us today is Dr. Roger Bayless, a professor at UC Merced and director of the Sierra Nevada Research Institute. He is one of the researchers who helped write this report. Thanks and welcome, Dr. Roger Bayless.
I'm happy to be with you. Very happy to be with you.
Well, the report looked at, you know, a number of areas. It looked at the Valley's air quality, the water, land use, energy development, all over the past 5 years. Now, what was the basic conclusion that you came after this, doing this research?
One conclusion, general across all the areas, is that we're making some progress, and we have a long ways to go in order to have a sustainable future in the Central Valley. A sustainable future is possible, but we can't just sit by and let things happen. There needs to be some very active intervention on the behalf of the government and business communities.
And, you know, what are some of the things that make trying to accomplish what we want to in these areas, in the Central Valley, what are some of the challenges as far as just the region itself?
A challenge, and let me take air quality first, and then I can come to water security.
Okay, let's go ahead and start with air and air quality, because we know that's something we have been struggling with for decades here in the Central Valley.
Okay. Well, air quality is improving, or at least it's not getting worse. And for the health of those living in the region, it needs to improve much more. This report really didn't identify any big steps on the horizon that will result in significant improvements, but it's clearly an area that needs more attention in order to improve our health related to things like asthma and other respiratory issues that relate to air quality.
You know, we do have certain standards, and we are trying to meet certain goals by a certain time. But is that enough?
Well, we're trying to meet goals. Improving our health means making more rapid progress on those goals. You asked for some of the challenges. One of the challenges is the shape of our region, a valley. So air pollutants tend to hang in the valley when we emit particulate matter, and those are some external sources and some internal sources. Those don't get flushed out as quickly as they might on some of our coastal parts of California. So there's some things that need to be done statewide or nationwide that will improve air quality, and other things that we can take on possibly ourselves in the region.
What are some of those things? After doing this report, I mean, and you look at suggestions or recommendations, not only at a state level, but individually?
Well, statewide, the fuel efficiency and just, nationwide and statewide becoming less use of carbon and more use of, say, electricity, because that's associated with lower emissions. We're facing not only issues of air quality, but as a state and nation and a world, we're trying to address the challenges of climate warming.
And that is something that you mentioned is going to have an impact on several areas here in the Valley, including our water, and we'll get to that in a moment. But, you know, one of the areas that stood out to me when we took a look at improving our air quality and that progress had been made when it comes to certain pollutants and small particulates. But one of the areas that stood out was toxic contaminants. The report says that has gotten worse.
Yeah, I'm not sure which part of the report you're referring to, but in terms of the small particulate matter, we can meet the PM, you know, the PM5 or the PM, those air quality regulations. But the smaller particles that are below the size ranges that are regulated tend to get into one's lungs with much higher efficiency, and those can often be toxic agents. So that's an issue that we need to keep an eye on, and it is going to affect the health of the region independent of the regulations.
And we've seen that with it has, and our air quality has affected the health of many people in the region with just the large number of people who have upper respiratory conditions and illnesses. And the number of children with asthma. And you would think we hear about these reports all the time and these conditions and how it's impacting us health-wise. But and we are moving along. But like you said, in some cases, perhaps we need to be moving quicker on some of this when you take a look at how it's impacting the health of people who live in this region.
I mean, as a university researcher and as a representative of the University of California, I mean, the university can play some role in informing decision makers, but there are also political decisions that need to be made and regulatory decisions that need to be made if we're going to achieve this better air quality for the health of our residents.
And what are some of the worst culprits for the Valley? You know, in L.A., we know it's all the cars, and we have a lot of cars here, but we're dealing with other reasons for our poor air that has to do with just the makeup of the Valley.
The makeup of the Valley, yeah. As I mentioned, the Valley tends to trap air pollutants because of inversions, and it takes time to flush things out. So, yeah, we know that we have emissions from highways, from roads driven. We know we have emissions from stationary combustion in the region, and we have pollutants that are transported in that we have to deal with too. And all that mix creates a challenge. Now, as a university, we can maybe provide some guidance on what's the low hanging fruit in terms of optimizing emissions and so forth. But to actually regulating them, somebody has to figure out who's going to pay for it.
That is always part of the issue, is really taking a look at how we're going to pay for all this. And as we discuss that part, let's move on to water, one of the other really big issues here. I mean, it's something we have been fighting about and struggling with for years. Are we ever going to kind of get that right? Because a lot of it is really tied to money as well and funding.
It is. And you know, we part of having a sustainable future for the region is having water security or a secure water future. And the challenges that are brought on by the intersection of population increases, land cover changes, both in the Valley and the Sierra Nevada, and climate warming are just, in some cases, only beginning to be addressed by leaders in the state and the region. And, you know, one thing I think comes through in this report is the tight link, or the essential link, between the Sierra Nevada and the Central Valley when it comes to water, because the Sierra Nevada is where much of our water comes from for the Central Valley.
And you mentioned, if I can recall in what I read, you talked about how climate warming could definitely have an impact on that.
Well, it's already having an impact on water supplies in the snow-covered areas like the Sierra Nevada and other mountains of the western U.S. We know that as temperatures become warmer, there's a shift from more rain, less snow. Now, one central I want to mention the snowpack storage aspect of that. One central tenet of having a secure water future is having storage. And right now we have water storage in the behind the dams that are at the mountain front where the mountains meet the valley. We have storage in groundwater, and we have storage in the snowpack. Many people may not realize that the amount, on average, the amount of water stored in the snowpack is about half, equal to about half of the water stored behind the dams. And that seasonal storage, over winter and early spring storage in the snowpack, is diminishing as climate warms. So the question is, how are we going to make up for that?
What we've looked at, and some of our elected officials have looked at, you know, is trying to get a water bond passed so that we can have better storage. Is that only part of it here when you take a look at what you're talking about?
I'm talking storage in the broader sense, not just a dam. I mean, there's no silver bullet for providing long-term storage. We need to see how we can optimize our groundwater use. Here at the university, are having many conversations with water leaders about how to maybe offset some of the losses in snowpack storage up in the mountains that will occur. There's also a tight link between forest management and water management in the Sierra Nevada that we're trying to here at the university trying to provide the knowledge base for changes in management that are occurring and will continue to be occurring in the Sierra Nevada. We manage our forests for fire to prevent wildfires. We manage our forests for wildlife habitat, which is very important. And we manage it. I think we'll increasingly be manage our forests with an eye on what's the water impacts of that management.
Also, we take a look at water management, but we also have to take a look at water quality. And one of the things that we've seen, especially in this part of the Central Valley, you know, we have whole neighborhoods here who don't even have decent drinking water.
Oh, yeah, exactly. There was a recent UC Davis report about nitrate issues in the Central Valley, and there's other water quality issues. But I would say that water quality and quantity are tightly linked. And you know, one thing that we identified in this report that could help both management of both water quality and quantity is a more accurate and widespread water accounting system for the region. We talk about a unified water monitoring system that's based on low-cost technology, and this infrastructure that could be put in place that has really only become possible because of the recent development of low-cost sensors and cyber infrastructure. And I think that the payoff for something like that in terms of improving our management to get better information into our management as we meet these new challenges is something that the region should push for.
Okay. Now let's touch on land use here in this area. How are we doing in that category?
Well, that's tied pretty closely to the economy, and that's actually one section of the report that I'm not that prepared to say too much on, except that you know the land use, the urbanization trends have definitely slowed down in the region.
And they were saying partly due to the fact that of the slowdown in construction.
Yes, okay. Yes, very mm-hmm. much. That's cut back on our move toward urbanization and has left put less pressure on conversion of farmland to urban land. Pressures that we saw were happening in the previous five-year report.
And maybe many people aren't aware of this, but what I read was that more than 18% of California's population is within the Central Valley. Now, and there are always questions about just how much this region is going to grow or expected to grow.
Yeah. And, you know, in terms of a sustainable future, as we do that growth, we need to consider land use for energy production, which is maybe not exactly what you're getting at, but I think it's one point that is important for both the water and the energy indicators that we mentioned in this report. As we look toward having sufficient energy but with less use of carbon or more sustainable, we're looking at use of land for solar, for wind, and potentially for crops that end up as biofuels in the region.
And, you know, and there's so much support when you look at study after study after study of really developing our renewable energy technologies here in the Central Valley, saying we're ideal for solar and wind and some of these other alternative forms of energy.
Oh, they are. And I see these as a, you know, sitting as an academic and looking at studies that are done here at UC Merced, there's a lot of no-regret strategies that the region could take advantage of, I think, in terms of developing renewable energy supplies, less carbon-intensive energy supplies to meet our needs.
Well, what would you hope, let's say, the policymakers, people who are elected or who are in position to kind of take a look at this and implement some of this? I'm sure you're hoping this is just not another report, but I'm sure you're hoping that people, the people with the power, would take a look at this and start trying to pick out what's really needed and trying to work toward that.
Yeah, I really hope that the business and government leaders in the region will find this report useful and as a guide or as a stimulus to think about bringing investment for renewable energy that will have the benefits of benefits for not only public health but a sustainable future and potentially water as well as air.
And you could take that a step further, and I don't know if you're prepared to kind of link it or talk to it in this aspect, but some of the things that you're talking about, they also would bring jobs. And one of the biggest problems we've had here in the Valley truly has been the lack of jobs. That's why we continue to have these high unemployment rates. And, you know, developing this renewable source of energy would also be a job maker.
Well, thank you for reminding me that I should have mentioned that, because yes, the type of jobs that we will have with renewable energy are good jobs, and it will provide more opportunities for our UC graduates to stay in the region and have good jobs in the region. You know, because at the University of California, our products are not only students, but also knowledge, and when we can put the two together in new industries like renewable energy, I think that's a win-win for everybody.
Well, thank you for joining us. This was a great report. You really broke down everything, so it was very understandable, and I really do, just like you, hope people will pay attention to it. You all took a lot of time and put into this, and let's hope we use it. And I'd just like to thank you, Professor Bayless, for joining us this morning. Roger Bayless, professor at University of California, Merced, and also the director of the Sierra Nevada Research Institute. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
I am Juanita Stevenson, and you are listening to Valley Edition.
Support for Valley Edition comes from Kaiser Permanente Fresno and Cahuilla Delta Medical Center.
You're listening to a rebroadcast of Valley Edition. Welcome back. I'm Juanita Stevenson, and you are listening to Valley Edition. California Governor Jerry Brown has accepted the resignation of State Parks Director Ruth Coleman after learning the department underreported tens of millions of dollars for at least 12 years. A preliminary investigation revealed that the State Parks and Recreation Fund and Off-Highway Vehicle Fund held a total of $54 million more than what was reported. 70 parks slated to close this year were saved, at least temporarily, with help from nonprofits, private organizations, and individual donations. Natural Resources Secretary John Laird says the Brown administration will work with the legislature to see how the money can be used.
This is deeply disappointing because we just went to many partners around the state to get them to step up and cover the shortfall. And I'm truly sorry about that.
Secretary Laird says it's unclear why the money went unreported.
The investigation will have to answer that, but it was an action to keep it accumulating and not report it, not an action to spend it.
The Attorney General's Office and the Department of Finance will conduct an investigation and audit into the fiscal mismanagement. Assembly Speaker John Perez says the legislature is preparing oversight hearings to be held at the beginning of August to look into the issue. In her resignation letter, Ruth Coleman says she was unaware of the money and personally appalled to find out. The governor accepted Coleman's resignation on Friday and appointed Janelle Bielan as the department's interim director. So how will this latest development affect state parks that are already slated to close? One of the only state parks in the valley, the Mariposa Mining and Mineral Museum, is on the closure list and was scheduled to shut its doors on July 1st. But as with many things the state government, it hasn't exactly gone according to plan. Valley Public Radio's Joe Moore has this report.
Randy Bolt has a passion for rocks. Well, not just rocks, but gems and minerals, too. He's a historic guide at California's Mining and Mineral Museum in Mariposa. He can tell you about the state's official gemstone.
Which most people have never even heard of. It's actually one of the rarest gems on the face of the earth. It's called Benitoite, named after San Benito Creek.
Or he can tell you about the history of the world-famous nugget from the California Gold Rush that's nearly the size of a basketball.
So our Frico nugget is one of the world's most famous existing gold specimens anywhere, partly because of its quality and beauty and size, but also because it actually survived the 1800s.
Randy knows the state's official gem and mineral collection better than perhaps anyone around. But these days, he and the two other remaining staff members at the museum are spending much of their time packing up the collection, getting ready to put it in storage, off public display for the first time in over 130 years. He says it's a sad time.
It's very hard to do packing, and, it's literally like preparing one of your relatives to be going off to prison or something, you know.
That's because this museum, which is operated by the California Department of Parks and Recreation, is among those expected to close this year, thanks to severe budget cuts at the state level. Funding for the state park system has dropped by 43% since 2006 and took a $22 million cut this year alone. In all, some 70 parks were expected to close this year, although the majority have reached agreements with nonprofit groups or concessionaires that will keep them open for the time being. But according to curator Darcy Moore, the State Mining and Mineral Museum, which is one of the few state park facilities in Central California, hasn't been so fortunate.
So we sort of made the list of the one of five where there's just no agreement, no concession, no donor.
The other four state parks that don't have a new funding source are Benicia State Recreation Area, Gray Whale Cove State Beach, Providence Mountain State Recreation Area, and Zumdowski State Beach. And just like those other parks, the museum was told its final day would be July 1st, 2012.
Now, unfortunately, it just comes down to, you know, literally dollars and cents. And if we don't have the money to operate the facility, we can't operate it.
But now, 3 weeks into the new fiscal year, the museum is still open, but it hasn't been granted an official reprieve either. So what happened?
When the governor signed the budget, apparently around $10 million was allocated to state parks that we didn't expect to have. But there are kind of contingencies or strings attached to some of those monies. So we were kind of told to hold off on closing until they can kind of figure out how that $10 million would actually break down and actually if it would, in fact, you know, make a difference to the closures ultimately or not.
The future for parks like the Mining and Mineral Museum grew even more uncertain last Friday with the surprise resignation of Parks Director Ruth Coleman after the revelation that the Parks Department had $54 million in two accounts that had gone unreported for over a decade to the State Department of Finance. Some have suggested that this newly identified money might help save parks slated to close. But others, who support Governor Brown's November tax initiative, worry that this possible case of fiscal mismanagement could alienate voters and wind up reducing the chances of the tax bill's passage.
Imagine it is probably adding to the, you know, question of what's the future of parks, you know. So, and it certainly is making things confusing for sure.
California has the largest state park system in the nation, with 278 parks covering over 1.4 million acres of land. Together, they attract around 70 million visitors a year. But the state's chronic budget problems have resulted in reduced hours, closed campgrounds, and deferred maintenance in excess of $1.3 billion. Over the years, there have been a number of efforts by park supporters to try to provide the system with a more stable revenue stream. The most notable came in 2010, when California voters rejected Proposition 21, which would have instituted an $18 vehicle license fee that would have raised $500 million a year to fund the system. Now, with the revelation that millions of dollars have sat unused and apparently unaccounted for, many park supporters are upset. They include Ron Udice, the president of the California Mining and Mineral Museum Association, a nonprofit group that runs the museum's gift shop and provides it with financial support.
I was very disappointed. I expected more from state parks. And, you know, for them, for the last 3 years, telling us they're broke, and then all of a sudden there's this money that they have been hiding, it's very disappointing.
Over the past few months, his organization has been working with the Parks Department on a possible solution that would keep the museum open. But according to Udice, the unique nature of the priceless collection made reaching an agreement impossible.
They wanted us to insure their collection, yet we couldn't really put a value on the collection, and it really never went anywhere. We tried negotiating back and forth, but in order for us to insure that collection, it's not even our property. It belongs to the state. It's currently self-insured. And our association in the past has run the Mineral Museum before State Parks took over. But State Parks has really fierce guidelines to follow and just something that I don't think that we're prepared to do.
He says in the big picture, the $80,000 a year that would be needed to keep the museum open at the minimum staffing level is a small amount.
And when you really look at the budget for state parks, I heard one of the rangers reference it as budget dust. It's like 0.1% of our budget goes to state parks. And state parks are our biggest natural resource in California. You know, they vowed to protect this land and all the assets and all the collections, and they're dropping the ball. And it really is a heritage for our kids and grandchildren, and to handle it the way they've been handling it is very irresponsible.
And if the museum does close, it's that next generation, California's fourth graders, who travel to the museum to learn about science and California history, who may be the hardest hit.
I think the big loss is going to be to the 10,000 school children that visit the museum every year. They get bussed up from all over the valley. They come up here and they not only see our mineral museum, but they also come up and see our history center. So they can pack in two field trips in one day and make it worthwhile. So, you know, that's going to be the losses, is the educational aspect of this.
Right now, the sad task of packing up one of the finest gem and mineral collections in the world continues.
It's a very long process because we have over 14,000 specimens in the collection, and so each specimen has to be, you know, sort of assessed and individually packed. And so we've gotten about two galleries done of the specimens that are in the cabinets. We're leaving the specimens that are on display, you know, until the last, so that if we close, we'll pack those, you know, last. So at least people have something to look at in the interim.
But despite the constant uncertainty and the threat of closure, Randy Bolt remains optimistic.
The state has said we can't afford all the parks. If your local people can support your local park and make up the difference, we'll work with you. So I think that's what the foot dragging on actual closures is about, is to maximize every possible day for local people to rally behind their local parks.
Whether the community comes to the museum's support or additional funding is found from Sacramento, at least for now, the museum remains open. A reminder not only of California's rich gold country history, but also of the state's current financial and governance woes. For Valley Public Radio, I'm Joe Moore.
Thank you, Joe, for that report. Joining us now to continue this discussion on this topic is Jerry Emery. He's the Director of Communications with the California State Parks Foundation. Thanks so much, Mr. Emery, for joining us.
Thank you, Juanita, for having me on.
You know, when you take a look at what has happened, this whole surplus scandal and the resignation of the parks director, what kind of impact do you think this could have just on the budget situation with the state parks are facing?
Well, you know, at this point, it's hard to tell. We have some rounded up numbers of what was supposedly hidden or somehow just not seen in DPR, the Department of Park and Recreation's budget. But the department has suffered severe budget reductions over the last 15 years, and in the last just 4 years, they've lost 33% of their budget. So our hope is that that this money somehow will be reallocated to the present crisis facing state parks, and that long-term, that the state parks get back to a funding level where they used to be in order to maintain our, you know, world-class state parks. But, you know, the political and economic landscape right now is so volatile. Then this thing happened on Thursday and Friday, so it's going to take a while to have the dust settle and figure out where we go from here.
I know it's still early and don't know if you have any information regarding this, but, you know, what is the feeling right now as far as how and why this happened? I mean, do people think it was intentional or just a huge mistake or bad management?
I hate to sound like I'm going to punt or talk around this, but we really don't know. We literally do not know. I mean, we found out just at the same time that everyone else did. We have been, you know, the California State Parks Foundation, first of all, just to let your listeners know, you know, we're a completely independent nonprofit dedicated just to state parks. We've been around for 43 years, and we have a very specific mission. Yes, we do work with the Department of Parks and Recreation, but we are not, you know, any kind of a government agency at all. And so this came to us as just kind of shocking news. We're pretty darn angry about it because as the in the great report that preceded this, Ron Udice was talking about how he was upset about the Mining and Mineral Museum, and we have been working this last year with folks like them and others all throughout the state to try to raise money to keep parks open, you know, to the tune of $100,000 here, $250,000 there, and the community across the state has just been going full speed since a year ago May, and then this happens, and so that's why I think a lot of people are very disappointed. But the fact remains that we do have to keep these parks open. So what's happening in Sacramento? Let it run its course. Find out what happened. Meanwhile, people like Ron and ourselves and all of our partners throughout the state, we have to keep our eye on the prize here and keep these parks open.
Yeah, and this is probably not going to help. It's probably going to make it difficult when you go out to those private entities and try to build these private partnerships, to keep these parks open and have to deal with people saying, well, you know, you have this money that you were hoarding. So it makes it very, I'm sure it might make your efforts even more difficult.
We've heard a little bit of that, but just some basic facts will put it in perspective. The money, let's just say it was $54 million. It was somehow, quote-unquote, hidden.
Mm-hmm.
It's in two different buckets. Some is from the Off-Highway Vehicle Fund, and the other is from the Park and Recreation Fund. And combined, let's say it's, you know, 54. If that was all rededicated to state parks right now, it would be a fantastic thing. it would give us a little bit of a leg up. A lot of these deals that are being struck around the state, and we helped out with an awful lot of them, still have gap funding needs. And so that money could be redirected to keep these parks open for longer than a year. But in the grand scheme of things, because of the historic downturn in DPR's budget that I mentioned earlier, and the fact that there's, like Joe Moore mentioned in the report, a $1.3 billion deferred maintenance issue in state parks, we're looking at much, much larger figures in order to bring the system back to health.
You know, and that was going to be, you know, one of my questions. Would this $54 million even been enough to sustain the parks? Like you said, you can always use the money and it could help. But when you look at the situation that the state parks are facing, this really wouldn't be enough to do what you need to do long term.
No, it would have made the last year and a half a little different. I can't look in a crystal ball backwards in time and tell you what that would have been like. Because the department, just like all the other departments in Sacramento, had to take a cut a year ago May. And so, you know, the Parks was told they had to reduce operations by $22 million, and the only way they could do that, foresee doing that, was closing parks, and that's how they came up with the list of 70. And so that's why the park community went into high gear, because the last thing you want to do is close a park, because a closed park is a magnet for bad things to happen, vandalism, illegal activities. Not only that, but then it's going to cost more to fix things that happen in that park when it's closed and then reopen it. And something that people don't realize is that California State Parks are actually an economic generator. Joe Moore mentioned there has been an average of 70 million people visiting state parks in California, which is huge. It varies depending on how you cut the numbers, but it's certainly larger than 50 million and maybe, you know, 60 million. And those people generate a close to $6 billion for the California economy. It's been estimated in a recent study by the state that every park visitor going to a park, buying stuff before going in and out, spends $43 a day in the local economy. So it's actually bad for business to close state parks. And so those are the reasons why we work so hard with our partners around the state. You know, they had a great interview with Ron there earlier. There's actually over 80 small and mid-sized nonprofits around the state. They're all part of the California League of Park Associations. And these are people that are, you know, friends of Park X. And these are the people who are on the ground, the local people, who are super dedicated to their local state park, who have been stepping up big time to enter into these agreements with the state. So our perspective is statewide. We realize we shouldn't get into the park operation business. You know, our forte is raising money and helping out our partners in the field. So that's what we've been doing. The last 2 months, we granted 27 operational grants that impacted 29 parks to the tune of about $830,000. And we're going to keep doing that. We're going to keep, you know, working with our partners and keeping these parks open.
And also what was mentioned in the park, and we continue to see this with a number of state programs, a lot of the state programs that are truly being impacted are programs that really aren't taking up a big part of the state's budget.
Well, that's absolutely right. And it was alluded to that California State Parks are really important to fourth grade public school classes around the state. They're the California State Parks are the second largest educator of our public schools, and they're just a great place to go for mental and physical health for folks. We have urban state parks. We have wilderness state parks where you can go and ride your bike. You can do just about everything. So they're an incredible resource for all of Californians. And I think that what really the crisis, that the scandal that has happened, highlights to us is that what is really important is the system or the parks themselves, and this incredible thing that has been built up by generations of Californians for the benefit of all Californians and people internationally. And, you know, what's going on in Sacramento is unfortunate. It'll be hopefully figured out. But, you know, our eyes are on the system and on the resources. You know, we'll get new people in Sacramento. We look forward to working with them. But we've got to make sure this system survives and thrives into the future.
You know, could that be part of the strategy? I'm not saying that it is, but the fact that you have a department and they sustain cut after cut after cut every year, to be part of that could be maybe to try to get the private sector to step up more and to take more of the responsibility for things that they enjoy.
Well, you know, we at the California State Parks Foundation, we work with corporate partners all the time. And then jointly with the state have managed a program called the Proud Partner Program, which is specifically a corporate program. And corporations around the state have been helping out the state park system for a long time and helping out the foundation with our Earth Day project that we've been doing now for 15 years and other specific restoration projects around the state that we work on jointly with DPR. So it's a pretty healthy relationship already, and it's this last year, you know, one of the great things that happened this last year, the silver lining in the crisis, was that people started thinking about new ways to raise money, to look at park management, to look at ways to create revenue from state parks. So a lot of really creative ideas were coming coming forward and being put on the table. A whole variety of public-private partnerships were being considered. And unfortunately, this thing that happened last week, you know, might put some of those in neutral. We're hoping that's not the case. And we think that our long-term history as being donor representatives and...
And the fact that you're a private entity might,
yeah,
might help.
And we have very transparent... operations were, you know, rated a 4-star Charity Navigator organization. You know, so we're very proud of our work, and we're hoping that we can just work with the donor community to keep going.
You know, that's part of the situation when you have things like this happen, how it impacts some of the good things that are trying to take place. And when you take a look at the state's budgetary process, it has really worn Californians down because they go through this year after year after year, hearing how bad the budget is, what they're going to have to close. And then somehow, you know, they find a way to patch things up and they move on for another year. Do you think just by doing that the voters are just weary and may not be paying enough attention to the process right now?
I think that might be the case, and one thing we want to do is see what happens this fall and try to take the collective temperature of Californians when it comes to new ideas of figuring out funding for state parks. But, yeah, I look across the economic and political landscape right now, and it's the Badlands. It's a rough scene out there. And, you know, what happened in 2010, your report – referred to Prop 21, which we were a major, major backer of for obvious reasons. And it just turned out to be a sour, bad environment. It was Brown versus Whitman. The economy was not recovering, and people saw it as just a tax, and it didn't pass, not even close. So, but having said that, we still strongly believe that the long-term solution to state parks in terms of funding is a reliable, sustainable public funding source. It's hard to envision that right now because of this environment we're in. But like I said, we've been around for 43 years. We're going to be around a lot longer. And we will get back to thinking about what that solution might look like in the long term. In the meantime, we've bought in time. We've purchased time to keep these parks open so we can take a little bit of a deep breath and think about longer-term solutions. We don't have one right now. If we did, we wouldn't be in this situation.
Are you hopeful that this $54 million will indeed go to the parks, or perhaps state may try to take it just to balance its budget?
Well, of course, we hope it goes to the parks, and we can make our voice be heard. But then, you know, at the end of the day, it's not our decision. It might be that the segment of money that came from off-highway vehicle goes back to that community, and that the that the $20.3 million, you know, come back to state parks because that came from the State Park and Recreation Fund. But we'll see. Hopefully all of it can be reallocated to state parks, but that's not our call.
Well, Jerry Emery, Director of Communications, California State Parks Foundation, you do have your work cut out for you. Good luck with all you're trying to do, and thank you so much for joining us.
You bet. And if your listeners want to find out more, they can visit our website at calparks.org. There's good education materials there, and we update it constantly.
Okay, that's calparks.org. Thanks a lot, Jerry Emery. I'm Juanita Stevenson, and you are listening to Valley Edition.
When it comes to the season of political contests, free speech is rarely free. What with nonstop political ads on radio and TV in many so-called battleground states. On this edition of Valley Public Radio's commentary series, The Moral Is, Fresno State Professor Diane Blair says the rise of the super PAC has big implications for the future of our democracy.
Free speech is becoming quite expensive in this country, especially as it relates to our political campaigns. The big story so far for the 2012 election season is the power of the super PACs. These new political entities are significantly altering the environment of campaign processes and political messaging. Partially as a result of the Supreme Court's ruling in Citizens United and a subsequent federal court ruling in SpeechNow.org versus the FEC, these super PACs have emerged as a new type of organization that can raise unlimited sums of money from corporations, unions, associations, and individuals. These funds can then be used to pay for political advertisements that explicitly call for the election or defeat of federal and state candidates. As of the first week of July, 657 groups have registered as super PACs, with receipts totaling over $240 million, and the numbers get larger every day. The only major restrictions placed on these super PACs are that they cannot make direct contributions to political candidates or parties, and they are not to coordinate their activities with these candidates or parties. Even though super PACs are supposed to be legally independent from candidates, the lines to be drawn are still quite fuzzy, and the degree to which they are functional extensions of candidates' campaigns in practice is of significant concern. For example, candidates have been featured guest speakers at fundraising events for these super PACs, and many former candidate aides are now founders and heads of super PACs seeking to elect their former boss. Even President Obama, who expressed his opposition to the Citizens United ruling and initially sought to discourage his supporters from contributing to super PACs, has reversed his position on these political contributions to try to keep pace with the amount of money flooding into the campaign process. Advocates of super PACs argue that they provide a powerful outlet for political speech. They argue that these super PACs can help create a more robust democracy by better enabling a collective voice for small-dollar donors. However, what the statistics thus far show is that most are getting their money from the extremely large donations of a wealthy few. The reality is that a relatively small number of people now have the ability to exert substantial influence on our political process. At the start of 2012, 59 donors had given $500,000 or more to a super PAC. 41 of those donors were individual millionaires and billionaires. The rise of the super PACs also seems to be benefiting one political party more than the others. Right now, more than 80% of the money raised has gone to pro-GOP groups. And according to the Center for Responsive Politics, 80% of the money raised by these groups has come from just 100 individuals. For example, Las Vegas casino owner Sheldon Adelson has said he might be willing to spend as much as $100 million to support the election of Mitt Romney. It is clear that Adelson believes money equals influence, and he is prepared to spend as much as half of 1% of his wealth to achieve that influence. By comparison, if the typical American family contributed the same percentage of their net worth, the check would total $360. If money equals speech and influence, then most of us are at a significant disadvantage in this process. If we equate political spending with free speech, Whose voice is actually privileged in this process? And whose interest is ultimately served? And just how free is our political speech? This new world of super PACs could become very costly to our democracy, indeed. For The Moral Is, this is Diane Blair.
The commentary series The Moral Is was produced by Valley Public Radio in association with the Bonner Center for Character Education at California State University, Fresno. The opinions expressed are those of the writer and not necessarily Valley Public Radio. Send us your comments with an email. The address is talk@kvpr.org.
You're listening to a rebroadcast of Valley Edition. Welcome back. I'm Juanita Stevenson, and you are listening to Valley Edition. While it is the Fresno Chaffee Zoo's first new major exhibit using Measure Z money, Sea Lion Cove, which is set to officially open on August 27th. And here to tell us more are Adrian Castro, she's the Director of Education, and Terry Mejorano, she's the Director of Marketing for the Fresno Chaffee Zoo. Thank you both for coming in.
Thank you.
Now, we did get a sneak peek at the exhibit, and it just looks, you know, marvelous.
We really, in design phase, paid a lot of attention to the details of what we were trying to mimic, which is the central coastline of Point Lobos.
And you started on this how long ago? How long did it take to get this whole thing constructed?
We've been in construction for just about a year now, and it was a year of planning beforehand. So we're coming up on about a year and a half of real intense work on it.
Tell us a little bit just about the exhibit itself. What does it house? How large is it? That sort of thing.
It's about 200,000 gallons, and it is has an underwater viewing area. It's a very large underwater viewing area. Has a lot of rock work. Like I said, the details were critical in how we designed this. So gives the animals a great space to live, and also gives us the addition to add more if we'd like. There's also a seating area for us to do presentations. We'd like our keepers to go ahead and bring them on, and also give our public some information about how we can protect our ocean.
And one of the things you talked about, too, this is such a great educational tool. The zoo always has been a great educational tool for school children in the Valley, but something like this you can really expand on.
Absolutely. One of the things that we need to remember here in the Central Valley, water is very critical to us for a lot of reasons. However, how we get rid of pollutants and how we take care of our water here does affect our ocean and does affect the animals. Anything that goes into the water or lines anywhere eventually ends up in our ocean. So absolutely does give us a chance to not only give our guests a great experience of almost being at the coast, but also giving them some information to take some action and maybe making some changes in how they do things at home.
Now, what can we expect on August 27th, Terry, when this opens?
Well, we're having a grand opening that day. We'll have a ribbon cutting at 10 o'clock. We've got the mayor's office, excuse me, coming out. The chamber will be there. Wells Fargo is partnering with us so that we can put on a great party for all of our guests. So we'll have different activities around the zoo. And then, of course, it'll be the general public's first view of Sea Lion Cove.
Wow, that sounds great. And with school being back in session as well, it's going to be a great opportunity for school children.
Absolutely. And part of our goal also is to provide teachers with packets of information that they can do pre-visits from to the zoo, but actually post too. So it's critical for us to always keep that line flowing with our school districts here.
Tell us a little bit about the new tenants to Sea Lion Cove.
We have a brand new little girl. Her name is Ariel, and she's actually a seal. And she was came from Albuquerque, and she's really – we have Buck, who's our seal, also a harbor seal that's been at the zoo for a while. So they've actually been introduced to each other, doing really well. All of our animals from the old exhibit have been moved into the new exhibit so they can get used to everything and acclimate to their area.
And I think also what this new exhibit shows – is because it has been such a long process, but I think it's because people really wanted to do it right, and that is how we go about implementing the master plan and spending the Measure Z money. And I think this gives people the opportunity to see what it is they are supporting.
Definitely. We couldn't do what we're doing right now at the zoo without the support of our community and Measure Z funds. This is our first major exhibit that we'll be opening that's Measure Z funded. We have done some improvements around the zoo, which are very visual. You come to the zoo, you immediately can see the improvements that we've done over the years. We've done facelifts on some of the exhibits. We've replanted the grounds, and so we've done a lot of improvements.
What do you think this says about the public? I mean, when you take a look at, you had a community who decided years ago to say this is something important to us and we want to support it. It says a lot about the community.
It does. We are so grateful. I've been lucky enough. I've lived in Fresno my entire life. I was born and raised. So I went to the zoo when I was 3 and 4 years old with my mom and my friends and her girlfriends. And so it's really, it's great for the community to show the support that we want to perpetuate making memories for families. Then it's generational. You know, now I take my grandkids. I took my kids when they were little. And so it's just great that the community continues to support us as much as they do.
Go ahead. I'm sorry.
No, I just want to add to that that, you know, in terms of the community, I hear a lot of positive things about our zoo, but also that, you know, the zoo actually can, you know, helps Fresno in the big picture. It helps our economy. It helps everything. When we built our Sea Lion Cove, for example, the rock work, it's a very specialized job. So we contracted with a company out of Wisconsin. About 14 people worked on the different types of rocks that we have out there, but 10 of those people are actually from the Central Valley. So giving back to our zoo, giving back to our community is also critical too, that, you know, not only they support us, but we want to, you know, make sure that the funds that we do earn stays here and as much as we can within our own community.
Now, we're taking a look at Sea Lion Cove and the planning with that and when it opened. What's the next thing on the zoo's list? I know perhaps we should wait till we get this one done, but I think people are really excited to know what's coming.
I think people would be surprised exactly how much we have going on right now. I mean, we'll have otters that will replace our sea lion exhibit, so we haven't had otters at the zoo on display ever. And so that's going to be a huge exhibit. The next year we'll open up a king cobra exhibit, and then Adrian.
And then, you know, we're already designing Africa, which will bring back those animals like the rhinos, the lions, and
a huge exhibit.
It's the big expansion. So we've already been working on that now. So our plan is to get that open as soon as possible. However, it's a lot of work. We did one Sea Lion Cove, and we're anxious to get Africa going, and we'll be back. We'll have great animals that Measure Z calls for, bring back those big animals.
When you talk about an exhibit like that, you're talking about a wide
We're talking
space,
about doubling
area.
Our, exactly.
19 acres.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yes.
People have to be driving around.
Right, well, exactly. Well, back, you know, nowadays, the zoo industry has changed a lot over the years. So we not only want to have our animals have great animal care, but we want them to have the type of social life they would live. Like lions never live alone. They live in a group. So those are types of things we have to keep in mind, which requires more area.
And so, okay, on the 27th, this exhibit will open to the public. And what time will the public, I know there's going to be a ceremony, but what time will the public be able just to come and enjoy that?
9 a.m. will open up on the 27th.
Sounds great. Thanks a lot to Terry Mejorado, Director of Marketing, and Adrian Castro, Director of Education for the Fresno Chaffee Zoo. You get a great chance to see your tax dollars at work and supporting something here that people in the Valley truly enjoy.
Thank you.
Thank you both. Well, that is all for today's Valley Edition. You can hear audio archives and subscribe to our podcast online at kbpr.org. We welcome your comments and suggestions. You can email us at talk@kbpr.org. Now for audio engineer Marv Allen, production and operations manager Don Weaver, executive producer Joel Moore, I'm Juanita Stevenson, and this is Valley Edition on Valley Public Radio.
Support for Valley Edition comes from the James Irvine Foundation.